I'm Celeste Headley. It's On Second Thought. In the Jim Crow South, the races were segregated by law. As racial tensions grew, though, some police departments added African-American officers to their squads. Atlanta hired 8 men in 1948, but their authority was really restricted. These officers inspired Thomas Mullen's novel, Darktown. I first met Mullen last year, and it's a pleasure to have him back to talk about his new book, the sequel, called Lightning Men. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's first talk about that title, because it refers to a specific thing. Who are the Lightning Men?
So Lightning Men refers to a group that existed in Atlanta. It was our very own homegrown fascist organization. They called themselves the Columbians. They dressed in Nazi brown shirts, complete with SS lightning bolt patches on their sleeve, designed after the Nazi stormtrooper lightning bolt. And they made it a point of showing up in neighborhoods where African Americans had bought a house in previously white-only neighborhoods, and showing up to intimidate them and start fights. They recruited other adherents at mills around town. And they finally got shut down in the late 40s when they went even further than that and advocated overthrowing the state government.
And what was interesting to me was that I would have assumed they would have been in league with, or at least friendly with, the KKK, but your books suggest that was not the case.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different variations of white supremacy. And you had the Ku Klux Klan, obviously, and then you had the Columbians. The KKK kind of looked down on the Columbians as these goofy kid dropouts who were a little too enamored with Hitler. Remember, this is after World War II. This is after we fought a war to defeat fascism. And a few years later, here we have a Nazi-style group operating in Atlanta. So the Klan kind of looked down their noses at them. But then you also had neighborhood associations that looked down at the Klan, even though they really wanted the same thing, which was to keep blacks out of white neighborhoods.
But it makes for such a great foil in a fictional novel, because you're African Americans are sort of beset on all sides. There's just, it's really, friends are hard to come by. And even the one white detective who has been helping them and certainly helped them in the first book, he himself says, I'm not doing this ever again.
Yeah, I'm always interested in finding the different fault lines in different communities. And so for a book like this, obviously, there's a lot of conflict between African Americans and whites. But I'm also interested in looking into what divides the white community and what divides the black community. So within the white community, you did have some progressives who wanted, African Americans to be treated better. They, wanted anti-lynch legislation. They wanted to revoke the poll tax and things like that. They thought black schools should be better funded. But there were also, they also still couldn't imagine a world without segregation. They still thought that the races should be kept separate. So there's a lot of disagreement among whites about how to do things. And within the black community, there was a lot of disagreement as well about how far should they go, how hard should they push. And so, as a novelist, I like finding those tensions and finding ways to exploit them.
I mean, it makes it sound like we're talking about a history book. And really, this is a mystery slash thriller at its heart. The problem for me is that it's really hard to talk about any plot points without spoiling, because you get a spoiler almost from the very beginning of the novel. The character of the first person who gets out of prison and is released is someone that I can't say who that is, because who he
is. That's true.
Is important. But he says this one thing, and I want to read it. The character named Jeremiah, he's just out of prison, and the cops have set up a system whereby somebody's released from prison can be sent back almost immediately to prison. And he says, why do they act this way? I don't understand this world, not this world meaning the outside as opposed to prison, but this world meaning everything. Does that sentiment change at all by the end?
Maybe.
As a symbol, I guess.
Maybe not for him, but I mean, all the characters are trying to understand what's going on in this crazy world. And it was a time of great change. I mean, it was right before a lot of the seminal victories of the civil rights movement that we learn about in school. Like the Montgomery bus boycott is going to be in 55, and Brown versus Board of Education is going to be in 54, but this book is set in 50. So all of those currents and threads are still going on at that time, but nothing's happened yet. And within the black community at this time, there's also a sense of disappointment. People thought there were going to be a lot of changes with World War II, since we fought a war to defeat fascism, and African American newspapers thought that we should also be fighting to overthrow Jim Crow at the same time. They called it the Double V campaign, the Double V campaign for victory over fascism and victory over Jim Crow. But that hadn't quite happened yet. And so I think there's a lot of confusion going on all sides. The world had just gone through so much change with the Depression, with the war, and everybody was kind of wondering what's going to happen next.
There's a point in there where you're, as a novelist, are imagining how these sort of backroom deals had to be made. And it's one where they're sort of, they're negotiating where the lines of segregation will be drawn in a neighborhood. And it struck me because many people think of the Atlanta Way, capital Atlanta, capital Way, as something to be proud of. That's how Atlanta has escaped a lot of the racial turmoil that has beset other cities like Los Angeles or Detroit or New York. But in your book, the Atlanta Way kind of feels a little bit gross.
Interesting.
It feels a little bit like people simply not taking a stand or avoiding conflict in order to keep the peace when they really needed to have the conflict. And that was all coming out of your imagination? Or really my question is, how much did you find out about how these deals were made or not?
I tried to make that as based on fact as possible. So you, again, yeah, I am a novelist. This is fiction. And so I'm going to exploit things for tension and suspense as much as I can. But I want the surrounding world and the politics to be as dead on accurate as possible. And you'll create my little fictional events within that structure. And yeah, the Atlanta Way, it can look that way. It can look a little backward looking back through time, especially, you know, after the mid-60s when you had this generational change within the civil rights leadership and, you know, a younger generation that came of age in about 60, 61, 62, saying, like, we're tired of the way that our fathers are going about it, this incrementalism, this asking for crumbs off the white man's table. We need to push harder. And, you know, obviously it's easy to agree with that now. In 1950, it was more complicated because, you know, Atlanta was only 40 some odd years removed from a race riot where whites rioted and attacked blacks and drove them out of downtown. So for black community leaders at that time, you know, they were working hard to win concessions from the white majority, concessions like black officers hired in 1948, concessions like allowing certain neighborhoods that had previously been all white, you know, opening those up to African Americans. And that's a scene in the book that you're referring to where some black community leaders sit down with white community leaders and try to negotiate, okay, well, where can black families move into safely? And looking back on it now, and one of the characters in the book, a young police officer, he's angered by this. He's like, well, we're bartering away where we can live. This is America. We should be able to live wherever we want. That's the perspective of Officer Lucius Boggs, who's kind of sickened by these negotiations that he observes. But his father, Reverend Boggs, who I see as a contemporary of Martin Luther King Sr., you know, the older wave of leadership at that time, you know, he feels like we're doing what we can to avoid another race riot. We're doing what we can to make things better for our people while avoiding violence. And, you know, I've worked hard to get this far. I don't want to hear you criticizing me. And that was a generational conflict that, you know, we would see more of in the years ahead.
So I want to read, I alluded earlier to the white detective who decides he's putting his family in danger by helping African Americans. He doesn't want to do this anymore. And his family situation gets very complicated in this book in a really interesting way. But it says, if any Negro officer ever asked another favor of him, he would decline. He wouldn't spit in their faces, no, but neither would he take a single risk for their cause ever again. He had his own battles to fight, and he couldn't afford to weaken himself by associating with the troubles that shadowed their every step. How much did you try to imagine yourself in the same position? To what extent did you think to yourself, well, what would I have done?
Well, first I should mention that passage you read is very late in the book. So a lot has gone on to get him to that point. And when I wrote this book and when I wrote the previous book, Darktown, you know, I was aware of the fact that in a lot of other books about race written by white people or films about race, starring a lot of white Hollywood actors, there's this character that kind of gets created of the white savior, where even if it's a story about civil rights in which you would think African-American should be starring, or at the very least playing a very pivotal role. Weirdly, through some alchemy, the story winds up being about, you know, saving the soul of the white people, or the white people finally stepping up and doing the right thing. And although that is important, I didn't want that to happen with my book. And so there is this character of Dennis Rakestraw. He goes by Rake. He's a white cop. And he wants to be better than a lot of the white cops around him. He's not a violent thug. He's not a racist. He was raised in a household where you didn't use racial epithets and things like that. So he wants to do better, and he wants to see the black cops succeed. But one of the reasons he wants to see them succeed is because if the black cops succeed and the city hires more of them, then the city will have enough black cops to patrol all the black neighborhoods. And
he
white cops like Rick will never have to go
anymore.
To a black... Yeah, exactly. Because even progressive-minded whites back then still had a hard time imagining a world without segregation. So he's being pushed in the previous book and in this book to try to do the right thing and kind of cross the color line to help. But it doesn't always go well for him, and it didn't always go well for some white people who did take those steps, and often they would end up going back when they'd realize how hard it was and the pressures that it put on their family, the pressures that it put on their business. They'd realize, you know, I don't want to deal with this anymore. This is somebody else's problem. I want to back away. And that's, he comes to that point by the end of the book because of some things that happen.
If you're joining us, I'm speaking with Thomas Mullen. He's author of the new novel, Lightning Man. It's a sequel to his other novel, Darktown. So there's another sense in this book of how small a town Atlanta is. So you get this sense of space, right? They're traveling, and in a lot of ways, they cover a lot of ground, both in this and the earlier novel. But in the other sense, it's a small town. And I wonder how you got there. I mean, it must have been through your research that you kind of kept thinking, look, it's these same characters showing up again and again and again, or at least that's how I imagined it.
Yeah, well, when you're writing a novel, you want certain little coincidences or certain plot lines overlap. But also, I think something that's been remarked upon a lot is that in the modern world, we lack a certain sense of community that our parents or grandparents had, that in neighborhoods, people looked out for each other or knew everybody. So it's not just, I'm not necessarily trying to say that Atlanta's a small town, but certain neighborhoods would feel small, and that, you know, if you were raised in the Sweet Armor community, you would know a lot of other people from there too, and you'd know their brothers and sisters and past girlfriends and things like that. And so through the course of the book, you wind up certain characters know each other better than maybe you'd realize before. And I thought that was interesting to play with.
Did you know the end of the book before you started writing?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know if I remember anymore. Usually I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, but I don't know exactly how I'm going to get there. So there's a few scenes towards the end that I had to figure some things out, especially with a crime novel where you have various intersecting plot lines. You want to make sure they make sense. And sometimes I'll be writing a book and I'll think, okay, this character is going to have a deep, dark secret, and I don't know what it is yet. And as I'm writing, I'll eventually figure it out, or I'll be doing some research and I'll discover some interesting thing that happened. I was like, ooh, I'm going to borrow that. So I think I knew most of it, but some of it was stuff that I worked out as I went.
And is this part of a trilogy?
I'm not going to limit myself to three. I think it's kind of fun. When I had the idea for Darktown, which was set in 48 when the city first hired its 8 black cops, I was struck by the fact that it's right before the civil rights movement really takes off, and that so much is going to change in Atlanta, in the South, and in America over the next 20 years. And as I was writing Darktown, it was getting longer and longer, and I was coming up with more subplots and more characters, and I quickly realized, you know, this could easily become like an 800-page doorstop of a novel if I wasn't careful. And I didn't want that to happen because not many people want to read 800-page novels. So I held some things back. So there were things in Lightning Man that I had initially been writing to go into Darktown that I later decided to pull back and save for a later book. So I don't have a magic number in mind, but I think there's a lot of different stories worth telling. And I think it'd be interesting to see what happens to some of these officers. You know, in 55, when the Montgomery bus boycott's going on and Martin Luther King Jr., a native Atlantan, becomes a national figure. What happens in 1960 when King moves to Atlanta at the same time that this younger generation of civil rights activists, you know, takes over and there are more demonstrations in Atlanta than there had been before? You know, what happens in the mid-60s? Like, it's interesting to trace the evolution of Atlanta and the evolution of our country, and you marry that to crime stories sort of as a, like the spoonful of sugar that makes maybe a reader able to embrace what can otherwise be difficult, heavy material.
Have you heard from any cops after they read Darktown? Did you hear from actual officers?
I've spoken with a few officers. I'm not sure how many I've spoken with who'd read the book first.
Or admitted it.
Yeah. But I've spoken, I mean, a lot of people have been interested in it. And when I've given talks, some cops have come up to me afterwards, or people who were former officers, or whose dad or uncle or cousin or sister was a cop, and have shared different stories they've told, not just in Atlanta, but in other parts of the country, and how, you know, different police departments have been integrated better than others. And in some cities, it took a long time before white and black cops could work together well.
Did you get any good ideas from these stories that you heard from either cops or their family?
Yeah, some. I'm always filing away little ideas because since I want to write a number of these books, I've got a giant piece of paper at home, two giant pieces of paper with different post-it notes, color-coded subplot ideas or character ideas or historical event ideas that I'm kind of rearranging as I go. But it's been fun. It's been fun to have a project like this. And it's been fun for me, an excuse to learn more about Atlanta history and become more, bound to the area that I live in.
But the people at the library near you must know your face and name.
At this point, I think so. But there's a few different libraries I make a habit of going to. So I'm going to different parts of the city.
Thomas Mullen, author of the very well-researched new novel, Lightning Man. Thomas, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.